This is In Conversation from Apple News. I'm Shamita Basu. Today, what the rise of a violent sport reveals about Trump's America. Less than 2 weeks after Donald Trump won the 2024 election, he showed up at Madison Square Garden for an Ultimate Fighting Championship event.
And ladies and gentlemen, look who is now making his way to the world-famous octagon, flanked by UFC CEO Dana White, 45, soon to be 47, President-elect Donald Trump.
Trump has been a fan of the UFC for years, and his arrival that night showed that the UFC and its fans love him right back.
It's so loud in here. It is so loud. It's always loud when he comes here, but yes. Now that he's won, now that he's the president again, yes. Oh my God.
Dana White, the CEO of the UFC, led Trump through the tunnel into the arena as if Trump were a fighter himself. And Trump brought with him members of his inner circle, many of whom have been appointed to key roles in his administration. Elon Musk, Robert F. Kennedy Jr., Tulsi Gabbard, and Speaker of the House Mike Johnson.
The mood walking into MSG was just kind of this street carnival of the MAGA movement.
That's Jack Crosby, a contributing writer for Rolling Stone. He was there that night in November.
You had people in full red, white, and blue outfits. You had seas of red hats everywhere. You had Trump t-shirts, Trump merch all over the place, people selling Trump stuff outside. Like, it was very much the expected coronation of the next president.
Jack told us this UFC event, coming on the heels of Trump's election victory, was the ultimate display of not only Trump's popularity and power, but also of the undeniable rise of the UFC and the sport at its center, mixed martial arts, or MMA. Some estimates describe it as the third largest sport in the world, with anywhere from 300 million to 600 million mostly male-skewing fans worldwide. And the UFC is valued at more than $12 billion. Jack recently wrote for Rolling Stone about the close ties between UFC CEO Dana White and Donald Trump and how each man has helped the other in their rise. Now, Jack is a fan of the UFC and MMA himself, and I'll add, my husband is too, so I've watched my fair share of pay-per-view fights. We started by talking about the draw of MMA and why Jack argues if you want to understand Trump's America, you have to understand the UFC.
This sport really is the new American pastime. We've had different sports culturally in America that have meant different things and have said different things about where our country is at different moments in its history. Mm-hmm. You had sort of the integration of Major League Baseball coinciding almost exactly with the civil rights movement. You know, you kind of have the height of globalism and American hegemony with the Dream Team in the Olympics, in basketball kind of really coming to the fore shortly after those, you know, that incredible run of Bulls championships and stuff like that. And my sense is that especially in the sort of sunset years of the Biden presidency, we had seen the country get a little bit angrier, that our politics get a little bit more individualistic, a little more visceral. You know, this is kind of philosophical stuff, but what I had seen from watching the sport and watching it develop beyond the parallels and the personal relationships between Dana White, the CEO of the UFC, and Donald Trump, that this was the sport that very much was of the moment.
The draw for spectators, I think, is a combination of things, right? Certainly some people are drawn to it for the athleticism. How much is the violence a part of the draw?
I mean, if people are being honest with you, the violence is the draw.
Yeah.
What I think it offers the fans is all sports are a form of fantasy playing out in front of you. If you ask anyone that watches football or baseball or something like that, when I watch someone pitching a complete and perfect game, you know, you're thinking, hey, man, like I could do that. A little bit of that glory rubs off onto you. When you're watching a fight, you get the glory, the good feelings of the sport, but you also get a little bit of that kill. That kill is a little bit a part of yours. The violence is a little bit yours, too.
It's a little vicarious.
It's a lot vicarious. Mm-hmm. And it makes you feel especially when you consider how polarized and charged and directly violent politics has become. You know, this is the language that politicians use now. This is the language that people want to see because people in America are feeling a lot of pain. And fighters, when they're training for a fight, they go through incredible amounts of pain and suffering. But what makes it worth it at the end of the day is they have a chance to put the other guy down and to win. And I think for people watching this, you know, you watch Big Knockout and you think just for that moment, everything's right in the world, that the right guy has gotten punched. And I think that Dana White and Donald Trump both identified that extremely early.
Yeah. Let's back up a little bit and talk about Dana White, because you write that, you know, the UFC just wouldn't be where it is today without Dana White. Tell me about him and what he means for the institution.
So Dana White is a fascinating guy.
You spoke to him for this piece, right?
Yeah, I spoke to him extensively. You know, Dana White is one of those people who appears to be shooting from the hip at all times, but is in reality shooting extremely straight always. He knows what he's saying and he knows why he's saying it. He's very, very similar to Donald Trump. It's absolutely no surprise that the two get along. I think what we can say about Dana White is that control of the UFC runs through him. This is a top-down organization. And that was another parallel to Trump. You know, this is the way that these guys are. They are top-down, single-control leaders. What's very important for White, I think, is that he has a very clear vision of what he wants to do with the company, what he wants to do with the sport, what he wants to do on a level even from, like, which fighters he wants to see fight next to why he wants specific fighters to fight. Like, the wheels are always turning and he's making those decisions and he has a clear vision for the company, which I think is why he's been able to build it into what it is today.
So in your piece, you describe how Dana White came to take over the UFC.
Yeah.
And it sounds like it started in the late 90s.
Yeah.
White was a boxing fitness coach. He was living in Las Vegas. He was close friends with these casino magnate brothers, Lorenzo and Frank Fertitta. Tell me about that time.
Yeah. So Las Vegas at this time is a major stop in the fight world. And it's also kind of a major part of the nascent UFC as well. Dana very quickly kind of gets a who's who of this industry and he starts managing some of these guys. And in late 2000, he's in a contract dispute on behalf of one of his fighters with the then owner of the UFC over what one of his fighters is getting paid. And they're going back and forth. And, you know, I was lucky enough to not have had to directly sort of negotiate with Dana White, but I can't imagine it's a particularly pleasant experience. And eventually the then owner of the UFC just kind of breaks and he goes, Dana, I can't give you that. There's no money. The money's gone. I can't pay these guys. I'm not even going to have the money to put on my next event. And to Dana, this is, you know, there's a moment in fighting, I think, that is so cliche as to almost not, but a sort of blood in the water moment. And I think Dana very much has that same instinct, you know, in business as well. And this is his blood in the water moment. And he goes and immediately calls the Fertittas. And he goes, I think the UFC is going under. I think we could buy this thing. And they do. You know, Dana White, this isn't his money. The Fertittas put up $2 million. They start a company called Zuffa Inc. And they buy the UFC. And by the beginning of 2001, they own it, or at least they own the trademark, because it turns out that the UFC at this point basically has nothing. They've sold off all the assets for scraps. He doesn't, crucially, have the video and VHS rights for the UFC. Those have been sold off to someone else, so they have to buy those back later, which turns out to be, from a business standpoint, very important. So he gets essentially this trademark for this fighting competition that nobody really knows about, nobody's heard about, and the people that have heard about it, for the most part, that are in positions of authority, don't like it.
Yeah. I mean, tell me about the state of the UFC at this time and how White manages to reshape it.
By the time Dana White takes over the UFC, it has professionalized a little bit. But MMA has faced a lot of opposition from, you know, the powers that be at this time. Politicians don't like it. Obviously, the boxing world and boxing promoters don't like it. And it's been legislated against. There's only a few state athletic commissions that are willing to really have these events in their state. And so White is very much facing an uphill battle when he takes over the UFC. And he recognizes very early on that if this is going to succeed and that if he's actually going to make money for it, he has to make this sport blow up and he has to make this sport go legit. And it turns out that he has two incredibly important allies in the very first days of the UFC for him. And before we get to Trump, one of them is obviously Donald Trump. But the first one that we need to talk about is a guy who's been involved in the UFC, not since the very beginning, but from very early on. And this is a, you know, sort of middling stand-up comedian. He's been doing sort of like sideline interviewing and a little bit of like play-by-play announcing and color commentating for the UFC for years. And he kind of gets his big break as the host of a reality show called Fear Factor.
I'm Joe Rogan, and this is Fear Factor. The stunts you're about to see were designed and supervised by trained professionals. They are extremely dangerous and should not be attempted by anyone, anywhere, anytime.
His name is Joe Rogan.
Sure it is.
Mm-hmm. And Joe and Dana hit it off immediately. When Dana buys the UFC, he realizes, look, we got to do a press tour. And so they embark essentially on a countrywide press tour. They're writing letters to the editorial boards of every single newspaper. They're going on every talk radio show. Dana says he and Joe Rogan are waking up at 4 or 5 o'clock in the morning every single morning for months to go on all of the early AM talk radio shows. They're getting on the, you know, the football guys talking to people as they're on their way to work. And Rogan, of course, is a natural on camera. He's a natural speaker. So is Dana. These guys are good at what they do. They're charismatic.
They're
going
all
over
the
place.
They're
talking up the sport. Mm-hmm. But the other piece in all this is, sure, you can talk up the sport, but you have to have a place to actually put on these shows.
Yeah. Where's the venue?
And at the time, John McCain, then senator from Arizona, has called this sport human cockfighting. The boxing promoters are all up in arms. And of course, the boxing industry is very powerful there. So, you know, they're lobbying the state athletic commission saying, don't do this, et cetera, et cetera. One of the states that does allow MMA at this time is the New Jersey Athletic Commission and Atlantic City. And White is searching for a venue and he finds a, you know, scrappy real estate developer and hotel owner who decides to take a chance on him, essentially. And that man, of course, is Donald Trump. And Trump and White sort of strike a deal. Trump says, you can have your first three events in charge of the UFC at the Trump Taj Mahal in Atlantic City. And White told me that this was huge sort of for both of them, both because it was the beginning of sort of their business and personal relationship, but also because they recognize kind of kindred spirits in themselves and also in their interest in the sport. Mm. White said to me specifically that the thing that impressed him about Trump is not only did he give him the arena to use at Taj Mahal, he came to the fights. And not only did he come to the fights, Trump came to the prelims. Mm. And he sat in the front row and he watched every single fight, White tells me. White realizes that this guy's into it and Trump realizes that he's into it. And he even says in his sort of victory party in 2024, after he's won the election, White is there. He's up there on stage with him.
He's a tough guy.
And he says,
nobody wanted to give him arenas because they said it's a rough sport, a little rough.
He says, I said, this is the roughest sport I've ever seen.
I began to like it and he loved it. And
so let me ask you to draw a few more of these lines more clearly, because we've talked about how Trump took this chance on Dana White, ultimately, you know, letting White host his first few UFC events at the Trump Taj Mahal in Atlantic City. What has White done to help Trump?
So in 2015, Dana White gets a call. He and Donald Trump have been, as Dana told me, it would be a little bit of a stretch to say friends, you know, but they'd been warm, friendly business associates. Dana says he specifically remembers one of the first times that the UFC got a write-up in the New York Times. Trump had this like printed out and in his characteristic black Sharpie, he writes like, great job, Dana, always knew you could do it, warmly Donald or something on it, mails it in. And Dana says stuff like this comes in over the years, that Trump has his eye on him, is always, you know, they know they've got that bond. And in 2015, Dana gets a call from Trump, and Trump immediately leads off the conversation, and he goes, look, it's totally fine if you don't want to do this. Everyone is going to tell you not to do this, but I'm running for president, and I would be honored if you would introduce me at the Republican National Convention. And Dana White thinks it over. And as he told me, he thinks it over and he says, look, this guy was here for me when I had nothing. I have to be there for him. And so he does it.
Donald championed the UFC before it was popular, before it grew into a successful business. And I will always be grateful, so grateful to him for standing with those in the, with us in those early days. So tonight, I stand with Donald Trump.
And that moment in 2015, 2016 is when they become personal, close friends.
And it sounds like a moment in which the right-leaning politics of it all becomes more intertwined with the UFC. Is that fair to say?
Sort of. I don't think that the UFC becomes explicitly more right-wing in 2015. The first Trump presidency, it definitely does, right? We see the beginnings kind of this placement in the culture wars, but then we get 4 years of Biden, right? My theory is that for Dana, the radicalizing moment really was kind of COVID, was the pandemic. I think it was sort of personally radicalizing for him. He talked to me about some of the sort of changes in how he viewed his personal health based on the pandemic and the, you know, new regimes that he's gotten into and his loss of faith in mainstream medicine and things like that. But what Dana White crucially does during COVID is he keeps the UFC running and he really plants his flag as this show must go on. Mm. He works with, you know, the Gulf states to start his infamous sort of fight island. You know, he gets his fighters in a bubble, not really, I think, because he cares about COVID all that much, but just because, you know, you can't have fights if your fighters are hacking up along or are sick in the octagon, right? He gets his bubble, he gets his testing, he does this. And for a long time, when all these other sports leagues are canceled, when people, I remember at the time, were like staying up until 4 a.m. to watch like Korean baseball league matches because it was the only thing, like Korea had like an effective enough quarantine mm-hmm. situation that they were still playing baseball.
Yeah,
you know?
Sure. I remember.
Before the NBA bubble, before anything. And I heard from so many fathers, sons, parents, kids, everything like that, that what made them UFC fans is because when they were stuck in their houses in lockdown and there was nothing going on, every Saturday night they could watch the fights.
Mm.
So I think this is when Dana White politically really, and everything associated with that slowly over the Biden presidency when he really starts to double down.
It was also around this time that Dana White recognized something really key. The UFC had cemented itself within a new media landscape, mostly podcasts and YouTube channels that had become a primary source of information for millions of young men.
That's who Dana is talking to every single day. And that's who his fighters are going on these podcasts. They're doing these appearances.
These are massively popular shows like Theo Von's This Past Weekend, Andrew Schultz's Flagrant, and Logan Paul's Impulsive. And Dana White saw an opportunity for Trump that Trump hadn't seemed to recognize himself.
Trump is incredibly media savvy, but Trump is, you know, he's a cable news head. He loves CNN. He loves Fox News. And White is the person who comes to him and says, there's an audience out here that you're not hitting, and they would love you.
At first, Trump wasn't so sure. Then in October of 2020, Dana convinced Trump to agree to a meeting with the Nelk Boys, a group of YouTubers on Air Force One.
It's great to have you all on Air Force One. It's a very special plane. You're a friend of a good friend of mine, that guy right there, Dana White.
Nobody like him.
Right?
He's a great guy.
But nobody, we appreciate it, and you really have a great future. Someday you may be, one of you may be flying on it as President of the United States, right? The way you're doing. So good luck. Good luck.
Thank you. It's amazing.
And it immediately goes massively viral. It gets a huge amount of impressions. And White said to me that this was when he was like, oh, all right, Dana's got a point here.
So Trump starts going on these shows more and more, and it became a major part of his campaign strategy in the 2024 election. His appearances got tens of millions of hits, but one remained elusive, the Joe Rogan Experience. An interview show hosted by the comedian turned mega podcaster and friend of Dana White, who helped him market the UFC. But Joe Rogan was, at first, hesitant to have Trump on his show.
So Rogan over the years has been a somewhat apolitical voice in American politics. His politics, I would describe, have kind of always been relatively incoherent. He expressed support for Bernie Sanders in the 2016 election cycle. I think he just sort of has a general everyman's perspective of someone who likes straight shooters and, you know, likes people that have something they believe in and can say it in an interesting way. And Rogan, I think, has realized that his audience for many years has started to sort of trend conservative, started to kind of trend into this manosphere. But he himself has been hesitant to really weigh in. And so he's hesitant to have Trump on the podcast because I think he correctly realizes that that would be pretty much a big turning point in his personal brand and also just sort of in how he leverages the largest podcast audience in the world. And what happens is White is at this point very good friends with kind of everyone in the Trump orbit, specifically Trump's family as well. And some of the people that he's close with are Jared Kushner and Ivanka Trump. So White takes them to dinner with Rogan. They really hit it off. And White has been saying all along, like, look, Joe, I know that if I just get you in a room with Donald, you'll hit it off and you'll love each other and you'll have a really good time. And so after this dinner, Rogan says, you know what? All right, let's do it. Let's bring him on.
We'll do it again. I want to do it again with you. Okay. You are something.
Thank you very much.
I said, how long will this last? Anywhere from an hour to 3 or 4 hours.
How long we do, Jamie? 3 hours.
Good. Well, we'll do it again. I thought it was great.
I think it was great. It was a lot of fun.
You are a fascinating guy, and you've done a great job.
And then the day before the 2024 election, Rogan officially endorses him. Mm-hmm. And that is really just the joining of this connective tissue that has connected these three men for over 2 decades at this point. You know, they've always been in each other's orbit, but Rogan and Dana were very close, and Dana and Trump were very close, and the other two sides of that triangle had not really connected. Like, it's all simpatico. They all are connected by the UFC, but they had never really kind of joined together. And that moment, I think, really made it clear where the UFC is at, where Dana White is at, where Joe Rogan is at, and that this company has firmly declared itself to be a part of this new political movement, to be a part of this new political culture. And right now, it looks like that gamble is paying off hugely.
Yeah. There's been a lot of talk since the election about how Democrats really lost a lot of ground among young men. And not just white men, but also men of color. Have you spoken to anyone who's been able to talk to or who has an understanding of sort of the Democratic side of strategy here? How are they recognizing this? It's been a huge blind spot, it seems to them, this culture, this movement that is represented both by the UFC, but also in this kind of bro-y podcasting culture.
Yeah. I think that now among Democratic insiders and operatives that they're is a scramble, and I haven't seen yet that they have a good sense or a good handle on how they are going to connect with that demographic again, how they're going to win these people back. UFC fans are not, these are not people that have been completely sworn over to the grand Project 2025. They're not sold on this idea of Elon Musk dismantling the federal government for parts and, you know, coincidentally, those parts now have to sign very large contracts with companies that he and his friends own. You know, they're not ideologues on that.
Mm-hmm.
But the Democrats need to find a way to kind of get themselves to the fights. They need to find a way to communicate with these people in ways that they understand. And they need to find candidates who can inhabit these spaces authentically. I don't think Bernie Sanders is the right person for this anymore. But like Bernie Sanders did Joe Rogan. And he was a hit on Rogan.
Yeah, sure.
You know, they need to find people that can that are genuine enough in their political message and can relate that political message in clear enough terms, and they can go into those spaces and make that case. Mm-hmm. And they haven't figured out how to unlock that code.
Yeah.
And Donald Trump and Joe Rogan and Dana White have, and that's why they run the country.
Have you asked Dana about the future being so tied to Trump's fortune, so tied to MAGA culture?
I haven't asked him directly about that. What I can tell you and what I have asked him directly about is that Dana White is one of Donald Trump's only real friends. Dana White's admiration and respect for and relationship with Donald Trump, I think is true and it's pure in a certain extent. White speaks extremely highly of Trump. He speaks extremely highly of Trump's family. He talks about what Trump has done for him. And again, he isn't really asking. Dana White doesn't want a cabinet position. He's wielding power in different ways. As we haven't spoken about, you know, he was recently appointed to the board of Meta.
Of Meta, yeah, sure.
And there's a very strong through line between those two companies as well, which is just that they are so dominant in their respective fields that the only thing that really presents an economic threat to them is the government, specifically the FTC, which a woman named Lena Khan is no longer running.
Right.
And so these guys are in the clear.
Right.
You know, Donald Trump's not going to break up Meta, and he's not going to break up the UFC, even though they have a very clear, technically the term is monopsony. They're the only buyer of the service, which is fighting, the only buyer of the service of professional violence.
Hmm.
And that's all that Dana White needs from Donald Trump. He needs him to make, if there's ever an antitrust case that comes across his desk, he needs him to make that go away. And Donald Trump is going to do that. I'm sure he's going to do that. And so I think that White feels good about that. And I think that what his thinking probably is that if there is another political turn in this country, that he'll kind of be able to roll with the punches. And he has a good chance of being able to do that because of the power and leverage and market dominance that the UFC has. If you want to watch fighting on TV, then you have to go to the UFC.
Jack, thank you very much for your time and your reporting.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
Jack Crosby is a contributing writer for Rolling Stone. His piece, Empire of Blood, How Dana White's UFC Conquered America, was Apple News' January Story of the Month. We'll link to it on our show notes page. And if you're listening in the Apple News app, we'll queue it up to play for you next.